The Bumblecast is for entertainment purposes only. The hosts' comments and opinions, and those of their guests, are wholly their own and do not represent that of any other entity. Content is provided as is, with no guarantees of accuracy or timeliness. Welcome to the Bumblecast. I'm your host, Kyle JCRB Krauss, and joining me for this very special episode of the Bumblecast is none other than Aaliyah Baker. Hello, welcome back.
Konnichiwa Gwan, everybody. Sorry, that one's for strawberry.
Oh, it cut you off, I think.
Really?
Kinda.
Damn.
It looks to do.
Start.
It's
so fun right from the start. I'm ruined.
Everything is ruined. Everything is wrong. Everything is bad. Anyway.
Okay.
Hello, Aaliyah. What are we here for today?
We are going to engage in a thorough retrospective of Sonic Super Special number 11.
Oh. World's
Rule.
Oh, Blue Hedgehog stuff. Wow, this is weird.
No, there's no blue hedgehog to be found in this one.
Whoa.
He doesn't exist.
Well, his name...
This is only for the girlies.
His name's on the cover. And he's in, like, one...
Yeah,
he's in, like, one panel?
Yeah.
Two panels? He's in a...
All panels.
Yeah, he's around, but... Yeah, he's very much sidelined on this one. For better or worse. Usually worse. Just to clarify, before we continue... Bumblecast is still not going to be accepting Sonic questions on the main show for the Q&A, but we're going to be trying to do some Sonic-related stuff on the side regardless, so look forward to that.
I mean, even his appearance on the cover is a bit of a commentary in and of itself.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, they basically had to put him on there because, of the fear that if there were too many girls on the cover, then the boys wouldn't buy it.
Comic wouldn't sell.
And I wish I was making that up.
No, you're right.
We celebrate the female characters, but we have to have a boy being indignant on it.
Yes.
Because otherwise it's ew, cooties.
See, and I figured it would just be the fear of Sonic not being on the cover means it wouldn't sell, because people would look at it and be like, who are all these other people?
So that is a bit of a thing. If you notice, it's not 100% consistent, but this is consideration. And you'll kind of notice if you look at a lot of covers, if there's an ensemble, Sonic will usually be towards the top somewhere.
Yep.
Closer to the title. And that is specifically so if the book is on the somewhere behind other comics, he'll still be visible.
Mm-hmm. And it's also like how Sonic would appear on a lot of Sonic Universe issues, despite the fact he was in almost very few of them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Sonic sells.
But, yeah. And that is a very important mantra to remember around a certain long stretch of this comic's lifespan.
Yes.
Sonic sells. Sonic was very, very successful for a lot of the 90s.
That's weird.
There's a reason that these books kept going on even when a lot of games weren't coming out.
Who bought and read these books in the 90s? Wait, don't answer that.
But I guess we're getting a little off topic.
We are getting a little sidetracked.
Slightly.
Yes.
So, but yes, this is basically one of the super specials, which I've often been kind of frustrated with in general because... For all the chances you had to, you know, expand continuity and maybe have more character development or heighten continuity or anything.
Yeah.
They were usually just kind of wasted on best parodies that weren't really worth the time or effort or paper they were printed on.
They were one-offs, sometimes crossovers with properties that didn't make much sense to cross over Sonic with, stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, coming from perspective of working on the stuff later, it's a bit frustrating in the sense of how much page limitations we had to work with to cram a whole lot of world building. And then just like, no, actually, what if we did a parody of Ally McBeal?
That wouldn't get That wouldn't age fast.
Well, gotta go fast.
Well, true. Well, hold on. Before we start, there's a possibility that somebody's listening to this and doesn't know who you are. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Ability.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Possibility.
Huh?
You say it like it's not a guaranteed.
What? Possibility that some people may not know who you are? I don't know. I'm sure.
It's endless possibilities.
Oh, good point.
Okay, if it really matters. It
does. Tell us just a little bit.
Okay, I'm Aaliyah Baker, and I worked on the Archie Sonic comics for 5-ish years, give or take. Depends on how you look at a whole bunch of things and how much work I kind of did behind the scenes. Also, the time I spent kind of trying to cram my foot in the door between editorial changes.
Yes.
But yeah, I did writing and coloring and lettering and some character design and a whole lot of off panels.
Yep.
All this in my grand effort to get to color a cover, which I did once.
Yeah.
For Archie Sonic and once for IDW.
Hey.
Wanted to do.
It's still awesome. And I'm still glad you got to do it.
That's what I was trying to do in the first place. And I ended up doing almost everything but.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Except for inking, I think, right? I think I even have an editor credit somewhere.
Do you? Okay.
I might. I'm not sure. Or maybe it's just a special thanks. I'm not sure.
I think, your credits are kind of weird sometimes.
Some of them don't exist.
I know you did a lot of uncredited work. Yes. Yes. It happens.
I know I did some work that, the credits kind of went missing on some. Oh, we've talked about that, haven't we?
Yeah,
but anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. But we're kind of.
Yeah.
Again, getting slightly off topic here.
Yes. Yes.
So
let's go back to this. The Sonic Super Special, Girls Rule.
Super Special, Girls Rule, which was ostensibly there to celebrate female characters.
Yes.
For the sake of the female reader base, which was at least considerable.
Yeah, for Sonic has a considerable female fandom, so makes sense.
And, in since that's not necessarily a bad idea,
mm-hmm.
It's a little 90s-esque in theming, I guess you could say.
Well, this was the 90s.
Kind of on the cusp of 2000s into,
Nah.
I guess Sonic kind of stemmed out,
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's the kind of, we have to, make a big deal out of it. Instead of just, writing the characters well, not using them as prop.
What do you mean?
Little things like, what do I mean? Well.
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah. We have 5 stories here.
Uh-huh.
Focusing on the very prominent female characters in the series, like Princess Sally.
Uh-huh.
Bunny Rabbit.
Yeah.
Julie Sue.
You sure?
Lupe.
Uh-huh.
And Hershey the cat.
Well.
Now, to be fair, Rouge and Blaze, or Wave or Marine or, a lot, weren't really things at this point.
Correct.
I said Amy Rose did in fact exist.
Yes, she does in fact exist. And it did exist at this time. This came out in 1999.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in terms of the comics, she, Sonic Adventure came out late 1998.
Yeah, about 20 days before this comic came out in
the US,
at least.
And she didn't get her new look until issue 79, which I think was early 2000s or so. So the timing is a bit iffy. But, the way Amy's character had been handled throughout the early, we'll say half of Archie Sonic, be kind of generous about it, is a bit funny because, on the one hand, it was, for a while, this might sound very weird, I swear this is true, for a while, she was not actually very prominently known.
Amy, you mean? Yeah.
In the Western fandom.
Well, yeah.
Like, she was almost seen as kind of, wow, weird, obscure Japanese content, almost along the lines of, also, there's this weird, bomb-throwing guy named Bean.
Yeah.
And you've never heard of him. Because they won't, bring the games over here, and it's super rare, and blah, blah, blah,
Yeah.
This is, the era when the Sonic CD manual said Princess Sally instead of Amy Rose. And it's kind of funny, because, I don't There are people who seem to think this was like some kind of like malicious attempt at like ignoring Amy's existence at the time.
No.
And yeah, going back, I don't think some people really realize how sort of touch and go the video game market was seen in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like early on, a lot of people were saying, oh, this is flash in the pan. This isn't going to last. And then going into the 90s, it's like, oh, this is still really being successful. It's not a big deal. It's not going to matter. So in terms of like things like localizing and canon stories and things, they didn't give a damn.
No, they didn't care.
They didn't care. You would get games where they would sometimes just make up something on the fly for the manual because they're like, this isn't going to matter in 3 months.
Pretty much.
So they probably just figured at this point, oh, for all they knew, this wasn't even a character who showed up in the game. This was just a backstory blurb so you could run to the right real fast.
Yeah, the only weirdos who knew of Amy Rose were the people who either had a Sega CD or were obsessed with Sonic. Mm-hmm. And or possibly had the PC version of Sonic CD.
I had it.
Yep, me too. That's mostly how I played it. Although the first time I played it was on an actual Sega CD, but then after that it was the PC version. So, yes.
I knew a couple people who said that I might have had a record time for one of the Sonic CD special stages, but that was like a million years ago and I could actually play games on a keyboard and...
Yeah.
Yeah, that is not going to happen anytime now. Don't. But yeah, you know, like they probably, like there's a legit chance that they didn't even know that Amy was a character who appeared in the game.
Well, she was in they the Sonic, she was introduced in the Sonic CD special. Presumably they had to know Sonic CD.
No. I meant in terms of like the game, the people writing the blurb for the manual back then.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant,
This was like... Yeah, they might have just thought this was like flavor text to explain why Sonic is running around this time. They don't care.
Okay. You know? I thought you meant the people who made this comic.
No.
Okay.
So, yeah. And I mean, they had Patrick Spaziante, who was basically their one actual, you know, gamer liaison.
Yes.
At the time. He actually did a lot of work for, I think it was Electronic Gaming Monthly magazine. Was that right?
I can't remember if it was EGM or...
I'm pretty sure it was EGM.
Something?
Then he used to do, like, cover art.
Yeah, he did cover art for... Stuff. Yeah, there was one magazine he definitely did cover art for, but yeah.
And, like, you know, there were the magazines that were, like, you know, run by the, you know, publishers and corporations, and then ones kind of run more by the nerdy fans who imported Japanese games.
Yeah, right.
So, the people who were a little more in touch with the actual content of this kind of stuff, which is why, you know, Baz's covers would often have all these weird, obscure Japanese characters crammed in them.
Yes.
Or people are going, oh my god,
or surprising.
Who is this obscure Sonic character that keeps showing up? No, actually, that's completely different Sega platformer.
Surprising references.
Sorry, guys.
Surprising references to other things. Yes.
Long story short, though, is that even though she's basically a core character, nowadays, and it's kind of hard to think, oh, who's a female Sonic character who would be rather prominent to show in a female promoting story? Amy was kind of considered a bit obscure at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't help that certain writers, I guess, just didn't really care to focus on her much.
Mm-hmm.
Even though when she was around, and they could have taken some time to focus on her or expand on her if they wanted, because at the time they were just doing whatever they wanted anyway.
Right.
You know, if Knuckles can be Kryptonian Jesus, then...
And also Moses.
I mean, Moses Jesus.
Yes. All of the above.
Mm-hmm. Even then, though, it is kind of funny to think that Hershey got Billy over
Amy. Yeah. Yeah.
Over Amy.
See, and I kind of liked Hershey, at least at the time. Sorta, but she had not much going on for her, so...
She didn't have much going on for her, ever.
No, that's what I said. She never had much going on for her. That's what I meant.
Well, it's not the first story, but we can start with Hershey's story, because
okay.
It's really...
Okay.
Touch on anything.
We can go a little out of order. Yeah, it doesn't... None of these stories really touch on a whole heck of a lot.
More lasting consequences than others, but...
Yeah, yeah.
So, I guess it's worth pointing out, though, also, every single story in this special to celebrate, I guess, female excellence is written by Ken Penders.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, there were no female writers.
No, of course not. In comics?
I know.
Crazy.
Weird. Gross. And Hershey, I guess, was literally kind of a pet character.
Uh-huh.
For Ken, as in she's named after a family cat.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it was like his cat or his kid's cat, someone's cat. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, she was introduced in Endgame.
Yes.
Which was, you know, kind of written as a potential cutoff point for the series if it wasn't going to last beyond that point. They didn't know if it was going to or not. And she was basically a plot device. I'm sorry. That's the best way to say it. She didn't exist before Endgame.
No.
She wasn't introduced in any capacity before her role necessitated it. And her role was basically that of Drago's doormat girlfriend who did whatever he told her to do, no matter how ridiculous and implausible and self-destructive and does not make any sense unless she literally no thought until what he's ordering her to do. She just does it.
Yeah.
And this basically culminates with her being the one to almost kill Sally Acorn.
Right.
By accident.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she was never intending to kill anyone. So.
Okay.
I guess all along she was just, you know, supposed to accidentally maim.
She was just cutting that rope for fun.
Yeah.
I guess.
She thought she was just going to mildly hurt Robotnik's second in command.
Uh-huh.
On orders from her boyfriend for something.
For some reason.
And then she found out she'd been tricked by her jerk-ass boyfriend.
Yes.
And beat him up a bit and threw rocks at his head, which, you know, fair.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess everyone just forgave her because she didn't mean it. You know, the killing Sally part, not the throwing rocks at Drago's head part.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I forgive her for that one.
I mean, everyone should. She should have thrown more rock. Anyway. So in the aftermath of Endgame, when they kind of just had everyone doing, like, reconstruction work in Mobitropolis, she was just kind of out there doing some kind of organization stuff, I guess. A computer didn't really, like, even, you know, basically Jeffrey shows up and kind of offhand belittles what she's doing.
Right, yeah.
And literally just kind of hands her something vague. I don't know, like a flash drive. It doesn't even show what it is.
Doesn't
like,
even can't tell, yeah.
Yeah, and just says, you know, show up at like the armory later. Doesn't ask her if she's interested in a job or tells her what this is or, you know, gives her any kind of insight or options or
any indication of what's going on. Yeah, she didn't.
Any indication.
It's just nothing. Yeah. Take this
vague thing and show up here later.
Uh-huh. Well, I had to play up the mystery.
Join my secret spy team, by the way.
Yes.
Which is what ends up happening. And then while she's part of the secret spy team, which he wants her to be part of, I guess he really admired the way that she showed up out of nowhere to assassinate somebody. I don't know.
I have no idea.
No one knows where she got these skills from to begin with, but I guess she just had it in her all this time.
She just is.
She just is.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, she just shows up and in training is basically like, what does she do? I think she gets thrown into a tank of water and has to be rescued by the others as part of the team building.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
And
wow, that's
a lot of like, I'm a cat. I don't like water. And I think they do like, there's like another little backstory of them doing like some other secret agent training mission crap where she's basically like, found a cart with wheels. You men just don't pay attention to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, now she's a full-fledged secret agent, you know?
Of course.
She's gone solid Snake.
Uh-huh.
Here.
She's got her own logo and everything.
Her own logo. Hershey Solo. From Hershey Chocolate.
Yep. She's got her own logo. There it is.
Yeah. So, basically, this is her story of her crawling in to ducks
uh-huh.
to talk to things and spy on Eggman.
Yes.
And use really contrived code words and things. And I don't know, it's kind of...
It's like she's eavesdropping and spying on Eggman, but there's nothing going on. Like, Eggman's not doing anything.
Not really.
Like, what is she spying? What is she learning from this? Nothing.
It basically kind of makes some offhand, you know, mentions that are kind of a, here's a wink, wink, nod, nod. So if you're reading, you know, the other issues and the mainline stuff or whatever,
right,
then, oh, you know what this refers to, but so what?
Yeah.
Wow. Eggman is conquering stuff in other places and people are fighting back. That's a big shock.
Yeah. And it goes nowhere, like everything does at this time.
The thing that bugs me is that she basically is like, you know, she's like, okay, she needs to get to the terminal. So she, you know, calls in a distraction from Jeffrey. So he sets off an explosion somewhere.
Yes. It's a huge explosion, by the way.
Yeah. Just casual, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah, whatever. Boom. Send in, you know, the bomber planes or whatever. And Eggman's like, yeah, whatever. And she's like, that sure did the trick. Not.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is still in the 90s.
Of course.
So that didn't work. So then she activates. She has to tell you, with the press of a button, the hand mine is set and on its way. You know. So it's a hand mine, I guess.
Why couldn't you just call it a grenade?
No, this is Mobius. They're very different.
Just okay, like how
they don't drink coffee. They drink Chono.
Oh, okay, that's right. Everything's got to have its own name. Its own name, except not. Except when it
except
doesn't.
Mines don't really work that way compared to grenades. But yeah, whatever.
Yeah, no,
the
I thing know.
Is, she throws it down the hallway, and there's no explosion.
Not immediately, no.
Well, so you know, it just goes pick, 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 and. It's implied Eggman hears something, so he does walk off because that warrants his personal attention.
Okay, yeah.
And she, you know, gets into the database, click, 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 you're in kind of thing.
Yeah, she gets into the computer. And
this is where she learns that their teammate, Valdez, as a certain blog says, is totally not SPO with a hat, which is fine because he doesn't even have the hat at this point.
True.
She finds that he was roboticized.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because here she's like, even learning that he had died would be certainly preferable, finding that he was roboticized.
Rude.
Which is a bit of a twist on the way the narrative has played robotization so far.
Yeah, yeah. It's like
because
a fate worse than death? Not usually. They could reverse it, I believe, at this time.
The thing that's reversible.
Yeah.
And has been reversible. Repeatedly?
Yes.
That has already happened to several characters?
Yes.
Over and over and over?
Uh-huh.
No. Oh, he might as well be dead.
Uh-huh.
And keep that in mind for another story.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, yes. Just screw Valdez. Might as well be dead.
Yep. Forget him.
So, she goes to report in that her mission is accomplished because she confirmed that they definitely lost Valdez.
All right. Which,
I mean... You could kind of figure they already knew this.
Yeah, yeah. If she was hacking into Eggman's computers, why didn't she learn any other information? Anything useful?
Anything useful?
Yes.
And, yeah, no, we definitely lost him.
He's gone.
Except, again, all the times that they've made so much effort to recover people who've been roboticized.
Yes, they've reversed it multiple times.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We have to save Uncle Chuck.
Yeah.
We have to restore King Acorn from everything.
Right.
You know, like, Sonic's been roboticized. Knuckles has been roboticized. Sally has done it at least once or twice by this point.
Yes.
Tons of people. It's, you know, some people have gone through a revolving door of it. But anyway. But it's okay, you know. It says she left a message that payback would be coming.
Uh-huh.
So she set yet another bomb. Which I presumably went off under Robotnik's desk.
In his face, supposedly? It's very unclear. Doesn't show anything.
So I just find something about the setup of the explosions kind of funny.
Uh-huh.
As distractions and things. This is their, you know, in-depth spy work written by someone who is a great fan of the James Bond series.
Uh-huh. And the best they could do is come up with explosives, except for the one, the hand mine that didn't explode, apparently.
The number of, like, James Bond-esque tropes that don't make any sense and don't actually accomplish anything?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, okay, so yeah, city blows up.
Uh-huh.
Hand mine goes down, which I guess the sound of it being thrown catches Robotnik's attention, but it apparently doesn't blow up because he says there was no sign of trouble anywhere.
Yeah.
But then when he comes back, there's a bomb hidden under his table or desk or whatever, which is phrased as
payback.
Or she's saying, yeah, no, payback that would be coming later.
Oh.
So it's not even the payback.
Oh.
So what is this one then? Or maybe she threw the hand mine, it rolled down the hallway, came back, and she attached it under the desk, all off screen because these stories are very short.
Yes, this is only 6 pages.
It's a very odd construction.
Yes.
It's also kind of funny that basically if you, and this is probably a very unintentional parallel, but the whole story is, you know, Jeffrey playing spotter off the top of a roof while she goes rappelling down the side. This is basically what happened in Endgame.
Yeah, yeah.
Only he's not wearing a convenient Sonic mask that makes everyone look like Snively.
Yes, that's how that works.
Anyway, so...
Yeah.
That's Hershey's story, which was apparently about stressing her independence.
Oh, except she's still reliant on Jeffrey. Don't you feel empoweredly?
No.
Oh, why not?
Job.
I don't think your headset did not like you yelling that. It did not pick that up at all. It picked up the last word of that sentence, whatever it was. Something about a job.
I said she didn't even choose this job.
True. True.
Like, she, what is her drive for any of this? Did she want to do this to make up for what she did during Endgame? Did she want to have more independence and strength and not just go along with what men were telling her to do,
mm-hmm.
aka Drago? We don't know.
No,
we don't know.
It never comes up. It probably could have been worked in here. You wouldn't need that much more text to probably outline that.
No, give her some motivation,
yeah,
or drive, or personality, because I'm pretty sure, like, every, like, third time she shows up, her personality has shifted, something different.
That's, yeah, if she even has a personality at all, you could argue.
And, I mean, what are the bigger points of what her character ends up doing is later, she, you know, has a bit of a romance with Jeffrey and gets married to him,
mm-hmm.
which her creator never intended for her to have to begin with. So, and that's not even, again, a part of her character. That's basically because it disrupts the supposed 007-esque portrayal
uh-huh.
of Jeffrey. He's not supposed to be tied down.
Oh, of course not.
So he can continue to aggressively flirt with his boss's 15-year-old daughter. More on that later.
Yeah. Nah. No, thank you.
So anyway.
Anyway.
Girls rule. One of the stories spent on Hershey, who
yay
confirms that a teammate is dead, apparently, because, I don't know, maybe now their paychecks will be redistributed differently.
He succumbed to a very reversible process,
mm-hmm.
and could have and been they couldn't easy
him if they wanted to bother.
Yes, yes, they gave up.
Yep,
before and even trying.
So that's okay because she left a bomb to indicate that payback would be coming later.
Uh huh.
Also, you know, presumably this bomb going off under the desk had no lasting impact on anything either. Nor did the entire building Jeffrey blew up or whatever else is going on.
Nothing. There's nothing going on.
But this is the story designed to push the character's independence and
Okay.
Let us know if you think it succeeded in that.
I guess payback is a dish best served later.
Reheat it in the microwave at some point.
Uh-huh.
We're the Bee and the Berry. I'm the Bee.
Strobs. No, I'm the Bee.
Oh, my bad. We can get that right.
No, we can get that. Okay. We can get that.
We're the Bee and the Berry.
I'm the Bee.
And I'm Strawberry.
And the Bee and the Berry is an irregularly scheduled podcast where we talk all things Sonic, writing fanfiction, and fan creation.
We snoop around at fan events, review the latest and hottest Sonic content, and host interviews with our fellow Sonic fan creators.
You know, just girly things.
And hey, if you want, you can totally send us any discussion topics or questions you'd like us to talk about, and we might answer them.
Or we might not.
But hey, you never know. You can find us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Tumblr, and YouTube at The Bee The Berry.
Okay, we're running out of time here. Gotta grow fast.
Ciao.
Let's see. I don't care about doing things in order, so...
That's okay. We can talk about whatever you want to talk about. I'm just here for the ride.
Who are you? We move on to Bunny's story.
Oh, okay.
Is that a problem?
No. It's not.
So Bunny's story is called Upgrade.
Uh-huh.
Now, in terms of the original Freedom Fighters, Bunny's probably one of my favorite characters, if I can count that in terms of, I guess, the base concept for the character and not, like, Nicole and quarter of that is what I myself did, so right. That's not really fair.
Right. Yeah. See? That's why we get along. We both like Bunny.
He's cool. I mean,
she is.
She's a cyborg.
Yes.
She punches crap. She's like, even going back a bit, she's arguably still pretty feminine.
Right.
And allowed to still be kind of, you know, the strong character, the muscle of the group.
Right.
Very pragmatic without having to flip all the way to, oh, you're cold and you're cold because of reasons, because of trauma, because of blah, 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 and that is in direct contact to your femininity and stuff. She's just smart, chill.
Yeah.
So,
she's awesome. Cool.
So, we open the story with her being unconscious on a table.
Of course, as one does.
Again, all the stories are written by Ken Penders. This one was illustrated by James Fry, who is often just known as Fry.
Caps.
He was an artist, just people who don't know at the time, was hired when there was a bit of a anime push at the time by the editor, which may be more evident in some of his art compared to other times, but especially when he's like going into like full like furry Tenchi Muyo cameos and such. But
right, the point where Sonic's eyes are huge and weird looking.
Huge and just, I think he can do good expressive art.
Yeah,
but you know, I mean, it can be hard to judge stuff like this too because sometimes you don't know what time limits are going for. You don't know what happens when anchors and colorists go through things. There's so right. much to through, basically. But anyway, in part, I also bring them up because I seem to remember he had commented on there being a push around this time for Bunny to be redesigned. So I don't know if that's the sole drive for this story existing.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, most people probably know this at this point, but anyway, you know, Bunny's entire thing was that she was way roboticized, and that left her obviously a cyborg, more or less. And then, even though the story was sometimes a bit inconsistent with these details, the idea was that Roeder had graded her cybernetics over time, and the general concept was kind of like once you, you know, started tweaking roboticized parts, you couldn't just de-roboticize it afterwards.
Right.
Because it's not the same base anymore. you can't hit the undo button on that.
It's the ship of Theseus question. Is it still the same Bunny if you replace all the components,
all the
Bunny?
Parts, and then try to hit the undo button?
Yes. Yeah.
And that does come plot relevant much later, but it's a little bit relevant here.
Yes.
Because the idea of the story is that, you know, Bunny ends up in the hospital because one day she just collapses, and they find through vague medical nonsense and pseudoscience that her body and robotic parts are no longer compatible. And the doctor basically gives her the options of, I think, like, you know, kind of stick with it and kind of see what happens, which is probably, you know, degrading further.
Uh-huh.
Trying de-robotization, which, again, with all the modifications and stuff, is super risky and probably not worth it.
What's funny is they bring up robot de-robotization existing here. So, you know, there are other events in this book that could be, yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
You mean it's not a fate worse than death?
No, and, apparently
and
not.
Trying to undo basic circumstances? No, shut up. Don't talk about that. Valdez doesn't matter.
Oh, okay. That's
Valdez doesn't matter.
I guess that's really the thing. Is that, yeah.
He doesn't matter so much that he was still in the crowd shots after he was captured and quote unquote killed.
Oh no. I don't remember that, but that's
yeah.
That sounds like what would happen.
He shows up after he's supposed to have been long gone, but anyway.
Uh-huh. Anyway, we're not talking about that anymore. We're here now.
We're here now. Mm-hmm. And then Bunny's most important option is, or they can, you know, basically replace the limbs, take off the current ones, and grade her. Hence the title of the story.
Correct.
So, actually some, you know, almost nice quiet moments in the story where she struggles with this decision for a little bit. Because, you know, medical decisions like this are...
Yeah. I'd say that this might be the better story of this book. It's not terrible, but...
I generally remember this story as being the best received.
Yeah.
Overall.
That makes sense.
And, you know, there's a bit of a sweet moment where, you know, Antoine comes in to check her, and Bunny basically says, you know, could you still love me if I was like this forever, more or less, which, you know, so is she still, I guess, holding on to the idea that she might be de-roboticized at some point.
Right.
Which, and he's just like, I don't care. You're awesome.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because, you know, he's right. And I kind of hate to do this, but what I find really frustrating, because this is a nice scene. It's a sweet scene between them.
Yes, it is.
So what kind of bugs me with this is that way down the line, as you know, Ian eventually had Antoine and Bunny get married.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken Penders had come in to say that, well, he'd also planned to have Antoine and Bunny get married eventually. So clearly this was a stolen plot point. Because a extremely long-running couple getting married is a totally original idea.
Of course. There certainly was no build-up leading up to it. It just happened.
No, just happened.
Uh-huh.
The thing is, with his outline as he and his friend / secret co-writer, Bob R., gave it, his version was going to basically have a 25-issue gap between the engagement and their wedding.
Okay.
Which, you know, I mean, some people do wait a while, but whatever. It was basically going to go from, I think, 175 to 200 in his mind.
200, yeah.
The reason, though, that it was going to take so long was that Antoine was going to propose, and it wasn't going to be that, oh, they got engaged and then spent X amount of time planning the wedding. It was going to be that Bunny didn't give him a proper answer for a long time because she was insecure if she, you know, about her appearance, her body, and if she was worthy of his love and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of ignores and negates this whole story.
Yeah, that flies completely in the face of this whole scene.
Right.
So, I mean, that didn't happen. He didn't write that story. It, you know, he wasn't working for Archie at that point anymore. But that was planned, supposedly, is a bit frustrating because, yeah, what, I don't know. Here's this lovely scene. Antoine comes in and settles her insecurities and reassures her that he loves her and all this, but it's not going to stick.
Of course.
Okay.
Oy.
Anyway, whatever. The last page is basically showing the new upgrade and Bunny showing off her much more slimmed down and, you know, is a Countess form fitting?
Sure.
Her non-Mega Man limbs.
Yeah. Her more feminine robotics.
Yeah.
Yes. But what's really funny to me is it looks like she's slapping the crap out of Nate Morgan.
Well, maybe she should.
She probably should have, yes.
There's also that kind of point where it's like, okay, well, who's the tech guy in town? I guess it can't be Uncle Chuck at this point.
I guess not.
You know, is it, who's Rotor?
Never heard of him. No.
Nate Morgan eventually kind of just is responsible for everything, including stuff that contradicts itself.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other...
That's a whole different thing. That's something else.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of other things.
I guess apparently Rotor was with his family at the time. I don't know.
Dragging out that plot point for them.
Not sure where the timeline fits in that, but all right.
Whatever. And it does, again, kind of bug me because it just, you know, it feels, again, kind of stereotypical 90s. You know, she goes from making this very emotional decision and having this sweet moment with Antoine and stuff. And then it's just, better than ever, look at my ass and talk to you. You go, girl.
Wait. Okay. What? Better than ever what? You'd go back to that.
We don't need to.
Oh, fine.
Just the posing and stuff, you know? It's, I don't know. It feels a little shallow in a way.
Yeah.
And like I said, so this was generally, well, seemed to be the most well-received story out of all of them.
Yeah.
I guess primarily because of the Antoine and Bunny moment.
Yeah, it's a good moment.
But, and I think they're, you know, I mean, Sonic fans and change, right? Oh, God, green eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people, you know, didn't mind Bunny's redesign. Other people did mind it, blah, blah. I think a lot of people weren't as fond of the particular method of the reveal. Again, the kind of slight tonal whiplash at the end.
Right, yeah.
I feel it doesn't really feel like triumphant. It just kind of feels like cheap a little.
Mm-hmm. I get
maybe
it.
Shallow.
I get it.
I don't know. One thing I did find a little funny is that there were some fans who had brought up that way back there was the, you know, there were some previous depictions, sort of flash forwards of the future of Mobius and the characters and on, where Bunny was shown fully de-roboticized. And most of those were written, again, by Ken Penders.
Right.
And, I almost said as we know, but, you know, some people may not know this. He had been generally rather adamant that this was all kind of a one timeline thing. The future was going to be the future.
Right.
Everything was canon, even though some parts pretty much blatantly contradicted themselves.
It was all set in stone. And this is what the future will be like.
Yeah. Not even just, you know, 25 years later stuff, mm-hmm. but also the in your face early stuff and all this. So yeah, people were like, well, if she got her limbs replaced and this is supposed to be a matter of she won't be able to go back, does that work with this? And basically told people, well, how do you know that's not like a clone or her sister from another dimension or something?
Oh, some more comic book crap.
Yeah. So there, I guess.
Uh-huh.
You guys are too limited in your thinking.
You're not playing 5D chess.
Yeah. I don't know if that really covers it.
Yeah.
But he never had Antoine and Bunny show up in his future setting anyway.
Yeah.
What little I had heard of these intended show up, I don't think even made any mention of what her state was, so who knows.
Oi. Oi, oi, oi.
Bunny's story, basically, it's an excuse to change up her design.
Pretty much.
It's got some nice moments in there, at least.
Yes. What's next?
I'm gonna move on to Lupe's story.
Oh, boy.
Well, I feel like everything is going to be increasingly a matter of, oh, boy.
This one annoys me. This one really, really gets my goat.
Not your wolf.
Not my wolf. No, my goat. Oi. Yeah, this one. Mm.
Okay.
Let's talk about it.
Okay. Again, written by Ken Penders, art by Colleen Doran, who did a few stories throughout the Sonic comics.
Mm-hmm.
I think she did some backups in the Knuckles stories, including the, actually when, Valdez, who, you know, is not quite dead yet, but has some very questionable everything in his roboticized state, shows up.
Yep.
To confront Espio, I guess. Yeah, she illustrated that one. I could be wrong. I feel like she might have done some illustrations for Wonder Woman.
I don't know. But her art's not bad in this.
I think this is comparatively a lot better than what she did with Espio, but...
Well, yeah.
Again, I don't know if, you know, time was a factor, or who knows.
Right.
Anyway, hey, female artist.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Crazy.
Working on Sonic. So, I do want to cover a bit about who Lupe is, because at this point, she is kind of obscure, and her involvement with the comic is a bit odd at this point, I guess?
Yeah, yeah.
So, basically, Lupe was an original character from the Sat-AM show.
Correct, yes.
You know, basically, like, auxiliary freedom fighter type role.
Yeah, kind of a random character introduced toward the end of the series, I think.
Well, I think she was in... Was she not in season one and then kind of had a couple cameos later on?
I think...
Or am I making...
Or maybe it was that way around. I forget exactly, but...
I forget.
I think she was just in season two, yeah.
Oh, if I have that wrong, I apologize. It's been a while.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been some decades.
She's a little like Kat from Sat-AM, although she's in more episodes than he was.
Well, she's also slightly more interesting.
Correct. She is. I like Lupe, which is why this story annoys me.
We'll get to why it annoys everybody.
Yes.
Eventually.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Lupe at least doesn't look like, you know, a D-tier serial mascot like some of the Sat-AM extras.
Yes. Yeah, she was in her own episode, and then she was in the finale, so she was only in two episodes of it.
Oh, really? I thought a bit more than that. Like,
yeah,
three.
Anyway. For some reason I thought so too, but apparently not.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, she and her wolf, as they call it, just the wolf pack here,
mm-hmm.
were sort of introduced again in part of the build-up towards Endgame. So I think it was around issue 46, 47, 46.
Probably would have been before 47, because 47 was the first part of Endgame.
Okay, so 46.
So it would have been 46.
Pretty much right before.
Okay, and, yeah.
In all honesty, they were kind of brought in to sort of self-introduce Drago, the I've never seen you around here before, oh my god, the shocking traitor of the story,
mm-hmm.
who was not part of the group in the show, you know, Spot the Canon Foreigner.
Right.
But when Lupe's group first showed up, when it was basically Lupe and Drago and a bunch of extras who were more or less based on the character sheets used as the filler wolves from the cartoon, they didn't really have any names or identities or anything.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of were used in the background of the game as, you know, combatants with like flamethrowers and grenade launchers and stuff. Don't ask where they got those from, but anyway.
Don't worry about it. Exactly.
Freedom fighters never use guns. Never have, never will, but anyway.
Nope.
And then, you know, Drago is the traitor and blah, 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 and all this, and that all happened. And at the end of Endgame, the idea was introduced that Lupe and her group were going to return to their home in the Great Canyon. So it's kind of like presented as like maybe their episode in the, or an adaptation of the episode from the show happened in the past, but it's not actually shown. It's just, you know, the Freedom Fighters kind of know these guys. They showed up and helped for Endgame. Robotnik's presumed dead after Endgame, so they're heading home.
Right.
Small side note, there is one later adaptation.
Uh-oh.
Of the episode. But we don't talk about that.
Okay. Okay. We'll.
Many hands.
We'll, oh no. Oh, no.
Many hands make some kind of work.
Ooh, oh, boy.
So, anyway, at this point, though, when Lupe is about to head off, the background characters, like I said, they were just kind of using the character sheets from the cartoon.
Right.
Were sort of set, put an asterisk on this for a moment, and given names. So, we had this big one was, you know, Canis and these two who are almost interchangeable, except for their colors, are Reynard. Yes, one's named Reynard, despite being a wolf. And Diablo.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a bit of a problem because the colorists will constantly mix Diablo and Reynard up. And I kind of think that Canis was kind of merged from two different designs.
Okay.
I know, because at one point when Ian had to compile, you know, that was his job originally, he was like compiling a lot of background info. It's like there's this wolf design that doesn't seem to have really been used except for when he was sometimes drawn into the background. So we were just kind of offhand calling him Ralph.
Good old Ralph.
Yeah. But had those wolves, and then it was introduced these two ones named Lita and Lyco, who are twins, and they're basically only told apart by the color of their body suits being blue and green, which is also a bit of a problem because Diablo and Reynard, who are also constantly confused with each other, also each wear blue and green, but whatever. So Lupe presents this story as being that, you know, they're all going to leave and head back to their home in the Great Canyon, wherever that is. And she talks about how they, and it's very vaguely presented. Like, they just say the Great Canyon, and they talk about, like, how, you know, Robotropolis, whatever you want to call it, was never home to their kind, even though it's supposed to be a kind of megapolis of, like, everybody.
Right, yeah.
Coming together, but, you know, Penders seems to really like his isolationism. Around groups, you see a lot of, you know,
sort of,
our people aren't open to outsiders. Yeah. We don't like mingling with them. We keep to ourselves. Like, the echidnas do it, the chameleons do it, and here the wolves are doing it, the cats do it. It's, okay, whatever.
Yeah, it's all this tribalism sort of deal, and it's like,
yeah,
assuming that an entire race of people is all the same.
Yeah, it's pretty, like, much.
No.
And they all always keep, yeah, they all have the same trait of keep to ourselves, which is a little uncomfortable, but okay. So basically they're telling Sally, we don't want to stick with the homeland we helped you guys free. We're going home. The homeland or whatever, any ideas of it are very vague. It's not shown to have any kind of connection to what was in the cartoon or anything. It's just kind of their homeland. It's a canyon, maybe.
Sure.
And what else is weird is that Lupe says that she left a husband and her family behind during the Great War, which
I assume
has to be a mistake.
That's a long time ago. Hold on.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, most of what was considered the quote unquote serious canon when it started being introduced in the comic, I should say, by the terms of the series.
Yeah.
Especially concerning the wars and all this kind of thing, was established by Ken Pender. This was his stuff, his timeline. But the Great War would make her kids, like, at least, like, 15, like Sonic and Sally's age, if not older.
Yeah, yeah, because that ended 10 years before the comic started, right?
Somewhere at least, yeah.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
Yeah.
So
that ended at that point.
So how old
it started at least like 5 years before that point.
Yeah, yeah, right. So how old is Lupe?
How old is Lupe? Question mark. How old are her kids?
Also question mark.
They're very much not 15.
No.
But whatever. So, you know, they have to head out and find their home and their people. They make some vague stuff about how, you know, these two new wolves, Lita and Lyco, found them, so they're sure the rest of their people are out there somewhere. So it's like, out there at your original home? Out there scattered? Like, are you heading home or not? I don't... It's like I said, a lot of this kind of presented very vaguely. Like, do Lita and Lyco not know where they came from? You know, were they just on their own all this time? Did they grow up isolated? They don't... Apparently they can't offer anything. You know, they're women. They don't have opinions.
I guess.
They don't have agency.
Well, no, not in this comic. It's kind of rare.
Yeah.
At this time, at least.
So basically, everyone had headed out from Robotropolis, Mobotropolis, whatever it is at this point, and spend a lot of times wandering around and kind of getting lost and off track because of the Days of Fury concept Ken introduced, which was kind of a... It kind of seemed to alternate between supposed to be like planet reset, biblical disaster level weather, but also just kind of storms.
Just storms, it, huh?
they just kind of did what the plot required them to do sometimes.
Yeah.
Basically, they're trying to head back to a fixed location, you know?
Right.
Their home, and they're immediately lost. There are rivers they don't recognize. They pass through cities they don't know. They have no idea where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
They pass through a overlander, which basically human city, which, you know, looks like a bombed out ruin for some reason, and find two overlander kids who are also twins. So now this group has two sets of twins with it.
That's not confusing at all.
No. You know, Lupe takes them on because I guess it's a bit of a, you know, human kids getting adopted by a wolf parallel story.
Mm-hmm.
And
also, they have absolutely zero dialogue in this story.
Well, they don't matter much either. Yeah,
apparently.
I think they're literally there for the sake of being, you know, human kids adopted by wolf.
Yeah.
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because even the thing is, their inclusion in the other stories doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's they're in the ruins of a city. They're two, like, let's say, I know, 10-year-old max kids.
Right.
But the Overlanders were supposed to have left Mobius.
Yeah, they're
at this point.
So they abandon these.
They abandon two. These two kids. Maybe if they what they yeah. again if like if they're that old. But I don't know if they grew up in this ruins by themselves the whole time, or if they came from. I mean, part of this problem is also because Ken Penders and Carl Ballers seem to have conflicting ideas on what happened with the Overlanders post war. So, you know,
there wouldn't be
it
any.
Could just be a massive gaping plot hole.
What? No.
But again, it's another case of the characters don't seem to have any context for their own existence outside of what they need to be on the page for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, oh, where are your parents? Where's everybody else? I don't know. Gone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Fine. One of the Overlander girls is apparently mute, so she it makes sense. She wouldn't talk, I guess, but.
Yeah. Sorry, I guess I kind of brought that up, but
that's okay.
In terms of like what they contribute to the story,
the chat reminded me.
I guess I could have brought that up.
That's okay.
And I mean, I could even say like in terms of those setups, it's kind of I thought a bit of a stronger moment for Lupe during these wanderings, kind of showing her, you know, being a bit of a decisive leader, being a compassionate leader, and I could again kind of argue, you know, showing a bit of a, you know, more feminine drive. Or strength, or whatever the hell you want to call it.
Sure.
Without feeling pandery, you know, because basically some of the other members of her group are like, ew, they're Overlanders. Rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, no, I'm not listening to you. I'm taking them with me. You know, screw you guys. I'm doing the right thing.
Right.
And it's like, oh, wow, Luffy's actually kind of cool.
Yeah, she is.
Right.
Which makes what happens in this story all the more infuriating.
Well, that's what I'm getting. I know it's a lot to explain, but
I know.
It's basically so because all they do is basically wander around through places they don't understand or recognize or know. They get trapped in some areas for I think a couple weeks or something, and I think they happen to be a necessary time buffer because they leave Robotropolis, you know, post end game. The heroes have taken back the city. Everyone's safe and happy, and blah blah blah. Now. In this story, which is titled Family, they and her ragtag band have shown up in the Western Flat, which is this the Great Canyon? Are they flats? Are they canyons? I don't know.
Yeah, something like the Western Flats, but the Great Canyon. Hold on. No. No, that those are two competing ideas.
Well, this is what it says, okay? I can only go with what the story's given.
Yeah, pretty much. It's okay.
They came home, and her interchangeable sidekicks are immediately like, actually, coming back here might have sucked, because it's another bombed-out ruined city.
Right.
You know, they left Moetropolis, and they're like, ooh, to live here, this place is gross. It doesn't suit us at all.
Right.
And compared, like, I kind of assumed maybe compared to what they had in Sad AM, they were maybe supposed to be a bit more, you know, down to earth, living with nature type, but it's just another modern city.
Yeah.
I guess. So I am not really sure what exactly their objection was, aside from our people stick to ourselves and our ugly sky risings and whatever.
Yeah.
And broken rebar and crumbling concrete. So they come back to the horrible, devastated ruins, and it's like, everything's gone and trashed. And it's like, well, maybe our loved ones have left a message somewhere saying they went elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, Lupe is very adamant that there's no way her husband, Lobo, would have just done nothing. Everyone else is very negative Nancy on it, but no, she's sure something has to be here for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then a missile just fires at them and blows gas in their faces, because that's what missiles do, I guess.
Yeah. Right.
So everyone gets knocked out and they wake up somewhere.
This is very confusing. I'm not sure. This feels like there's a page missing between page 2 and 3.
Oh, they come home. Everyone's like, maybe we shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And Lupe's like, no, it's fine. And then it's not fine.
Right. But then...
And then they... I guess everyone was knocked out and Lupe was the last to wake up, because no one seems to know what's going on until they are confronted by Lupe's family, who have all been roboticized.
Who could have seen that coming?
And she is very understandably upset by this.
Yes.
And oh my god, who could have done this? And Uncle reveals himself for dramatic villain monologue time.
Good old Uncle Chuck. It was me!
Yeah. It was me, Barry!
It was me, Dio! Wait, no.
Yeah. And as Lupe points out that, you know, he was with Sally and Sonic last time she saw him, because, you know, she left the city and everything was fine at that point.
Right.
So, you know, presumably it took them like 25-ish issues to get lost and get stuck in a city full of rain and whatever else, trying to find the city that they should know exists.
Right, yeah.
How did they... But anyway, in the time that it took them to get back here, a whole bunch of, well, pretty much all the Robians and Uncle Chuck and stuff were, like, recaptured and roboticized and rebranded, you know. And in doing so, I guess Uncle Chuck was just turned into a very generic villain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why Uncle Chuck of all times, of all people, I mean, sorry.
Yeah, because it would be shocking to the reader.
Yeah.
Not Uncle Chuck.
Not Uncle Chuck. And it's just, yeah, so basically he, you know, threatens and uses her family for as coercion to say that, you know, everyone walk into a roboticizer or I'm going to kill your family.
Right.
And so Lupe goes into the roboticizer and gets roboticized and everyone's horrified.
She just does it. Yeah. There's no resistance, nothing.
No.
She just walks in there, you know, herself.
Because he said he'll dismantle her family if she doesn't do it.
Uh-huh.
Now, then she has this, you know, moment where she does manage to shove all the robots over and start fighting them and yells at everyone to get out. And another moment of brilliant dialogue. I think it's Diablo, you know, with their interchangeable faces or dialogue or coloring. Or says, you don't have to tell us twice. And then turns around and says, what about you? We can't just leave you. Like, usually when you say you don't have to tell us twice, you're not hesitating.
Yeah.
You're not.
Yeah, but then he's like, what about you? It's like immediately after. Yeah. It's like, hold on, wait, hold on.
You don't stop and question things and reevaluate. Uh-huh. Anyway, Lupe, you know, yeah, so she gives them a moment and tries to tell everyone to get away. And then she says it's getting harder to think, and she decides she rather just wants to, all she can think about now is that she just wants to be with her family. And he's like, yeah, okay, that's what you want. And runs off. And amongst another case of a photographed background, there is abruptly a gravestone.
That's true.
For Lupe.
Yeah, all of a sudden a Lupe gravestone. What? She's dead? Yep. Hold on.
Yep.
Roboticization is not final. It's been established that it's not final, but now she's dead.
Two panels later, Lupe's dead.
Lupe died on the way back to her home planet.
Home planet. Her home canyon on the western flat.
So all that time spent following her and the wolf pack to find their home, and this is ultimately what it culminates in?
Yep.
It's like...
She adopted two children, and is told, you know, comply or I'll kill your family. But like, what is the alternative? Everyone's being roboticized anyway, and they're treating roboticization as death.
Yeah.
So like, she didn't know that she would have this last moment of willpower. So was she just dooming everybody else?
Yeah, that's, it's so weird.
It's weird. And again, like, you know, we're treating roboticization as fatal, as a one-way thing.
Right. Went up to this point, it so never had been.
Is Uncle Chuck undead?
Well, maybe. That would make him cooler.
Like, you know, did she see her family? And she's like, oh, well, they're dead. What do I care if they're dismantled? Hey, the way, Bunny, your choices are possibly be de-roboticized, which might happen in the future anyway.
Uh-huh.
But also, Aldez and Lupe are dead.
Even though they are roboticized, which is not a final thing. You can be de-roboticized. It's like, come on. Wow.
So, I probably don't have to tell you that this story was not that well received.
No. No, I can't imagine why.
You know, never mind. Again, yeah, all that build up just to a story with very little build up and an extremely abrupt ending in which, you know, a character who, for the few appearances she did have, she was at least somewhat liked.
Right.
Fans. And, you know, no, you're dead.
Yeah, she's just gone.
And, in my opinion, not helping this are the statements of intent story. So, Pen Pender's apparent intentions of the story. This was a story about playing up Lupe's maternal instincts.
Okay.
The maternal instincts where, you know, when your brain is falling apart, all you can think of is must be with family. Because, I guess, that's all your brain does and all your practicality and stuff goes out the window. So, you know, all the other kids you adopted along the way and the people you're responsible for as a leader and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Out the window.
Of course.
She didn't know she was going to be able to save them. It was important in his eyes because instead of depicting girls being rescued, this story showed that, quote, even a female can make the ultimate sacrifice.
Uh-huh. Even, of course, even a female.
Even a female.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Because mothers never make sacrifices.
No, of course not.
So this was, yeah, he apparently felt this was an opportunity to really make a statement with this character by killing her off.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm not saying, you know, yeah, you can never have short stories or shocking stories or, you know, sometimes you, as a writer, I would say, yeah, sometimes you do. I don't want to say just do something shocking for the sake of shocking, but, you know, sometimes you go for the gut.
Right.
Sometimes you do cut something off with something harsh to make an impact. I don't think this is it, especially when you kind of present this entire issue, you know, girls rule.
Uh-huh.
Let's celebrate the female characters. Girls rule.
Yes.
Anyway, she gave up and now she's dead.
By killing one of them off, yeah.
You know, but it's okay because she was sacrificing herself to save the others, even though she didn't know that was going to work anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And did not plan for it to go that way. She was basically, she did it under duress. She was coerced into it. And the end. And I, as much as we've been kind of harping on the, you know, is robotization considered death at this point? Mm-hmm. Ken made it absolutely clear that he considered her gone.
Right.
Like, people were commenting on this or protesting this or upset about this. And he said, well, in our continuity, she's gone. You will, quote, you will never see her or her family again in a de-roboticized state.
Okay.
So yes, this was intent. Now, people who, you know, were longtime readers or kept up with the book or whatever will know that this did not turn out to be the case.
Right.
I mean, it's a comic book. Death tends to be a revolving door anyway.
Right. And this isn't even death.
Robotization isn't, yeah, it has long been established.
Right, yes.
It's not death. But what kind of bugs me with this was, even up to, I think, like, just a few years ago? A few years ago. Like maybe, like, 2018? Like, just a bit pre-pandemic, I guess, or something?
Mm-hmm.
Ken was still saying, no, Pei, dead and gone, as far as he was concerned.
Right, yeah.
And if Ian had ever de-roboticized or revived them, as far as he was concerned, this was like alternate continuity.
Right.
The problem with that is that Carl Ballers had Lupe and her family come back, still roboticized, but, you know, with their free will restored.
Okay, yeah.
Had a big story about, you know, seeking understanding kind of with Uncle Chuck, and Chuck kind of finding forgiveness with himself for what he's done here. And then they were part of the whole big, you know, mass de-roboticization thing where it's every single person who was roboticized and not dead has it undone.
Right.
So, yeah, they did show up. And on top of that, Ken himself wrote a story with Lupe and her whole family and the entire pack here, all de-roboticized. it was when the whole Nanite City thing was introduced. So it's like early, like 150s or so, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Once again, they're just wandering aimlessly because I guess he couldn't think of anything else for them to do, but...
why are they there? If he said they were gone, why are they there?
And why is he blaming Ian for breaking the continuity and it doesn't count and blah, 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 and whatever. So, you know, she was already returned to the active cast before Ian was writing.
Right.
Oh, why Uncle Chuck? Like, what was he doing? What was... Oh, no, this small band of people was even smaller when they left Robotropolis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what happened to the city? Why is it just Lupe's family? Uncle Chuck was like, "Nyar har har, I will lie in for
I think it's 2 just weeks. For the shock factor. It's just supposed to be shocking that he's there. That's probably all the thought that went into it.
Like, I'll roboticize her family in particular because I know they're coming back here, and then we'll just sit around and wait for them to come so we can not even roboticize them while they're unconscious or anything.
Right.
Ambush them, wake them up, and then turn it into some kind of torture party for the lulz.
Of course.
Anyway, that's Lupe. She was supposed to be dead.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't.
Don't ultimately. You feel inspired?
No. Not in the slightest.
You know, it's funny. It's like a small thing, not really totally relevant, but I do find it a little interesting, is because of the way references were done, or rather not used at this point. I said how like a lot of the background characters were sort of just kind of merged.
Right.
Used off of the character sheets. Well, there's also the fact that at this point, a lot of the artists were basically just using older issues as their reference points and not real full turnarounds or whatever.
Yeah, which
so,
means the inconsistencies carry through.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of becomes a visual broken telephone thing, right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So basically, those two lines on Lupe's face are supposed to be a single scar from the cartoon.
Mm-hmm. It looks like she has a mustache.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, she could rock a mustache if she wants.
I mean, yeah, I'm not going to stop her.
She can do whatever she wants.
I won't stop her, but I mean, I'm just saying, that's what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was supposed to be a scar under one eye, but you know, artists didn't know what it was and just kind of figured, oh, it's a weird mark on her face.
Yeah.
And assumed it was parallel on both sides. So how are we feeling about women being celebrated? Do the girls rule?
Apparently not in this book. So far, I'm not really feeling it. I guess I'm not the target audience, but, you know, still.
Well, I don't think the target audience is necessarily enjoying this either.
No, no.
Maybe it's a small thing, and, you know, maybe I have the wrong context, but Ken always wrote Diablo's little quirk, I guess, is, you know, he speaks Spanish, and he always addresses Lupe as señorita.
Mm-hmm. Or bonita later.
Is that really applicable when, I guess, you're married and have 2 kids? Or 4 kids at this point, but...
I don't know.
Maybe it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
I just think it's kind of funny.
Yeah. It's a little silly.
I mean, like I said, half the time... He and the other guy, I mean, they're colored the same color half the time. They're mixed up half the time. Mm-hmm. When the wolf hack shows up later, everyone colored brown.
Yeah, like everyone looks different. It's very inconsistent.
No one.
Oh, well. Well, folks, this episode has gone on for quite a long time, and we've got a lot of this comic left to talk about. So we're going to split this up, but we'll come back with more on the Bumblecast. Thank you, Lee, for joining us here.
I'm sorry it took so long.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's fun to talk about this old stuff.
I just I don't know. I kept waiting to feel better about it, and it was never going to happen. So here we are.
Here we are.
I guess we can try to do this. I mean, I guess we know this setup works somewhat, except if I am too loud or...
Nope, it should be okay.
Too annoying or... Okay.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay.
It's perfectly fine. So we'll do this okay. again. We'll revisit these last two stories in the future.
Okay. Click the doom a diddle and hit the buttons and subscribe and send money. Did I do it right?
Yes. That's perfect.
Cool. Awesome.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, be good to yourselves, be good to each other. Go check out bumblecast.com. And sure, do that, I guess. And we'll see you next time on the Bumblecast. Alrighty, hit all the doomadiddles.
What am I supposed to say? Anything of substance? I'm not here to entertain people.
We'll figure it out. You'll figure it out. Don't worry about it.
You're probably going to have to, like, edit out so much garbage.
It's okay. I'm used to it. This is what I do.
Did I manage to not, like, at least swear a ton this time? I tried.
Yeah. You seem pretty clean, for the most part.
I mean, if you want, I can swear more.
I think you let a damn slip. That was it. Oh, no.
Is that not allowed?
No, it's fine. That's the most, only one I can really remember.
Are you being serious?
That's the only one I can really remember.
Damn, not here.
Exactly. Anyway.
Heroes, on the other hand, did in fact exist.
Wait, hold on. Oh, yeah.
Got a problem?
Oh, you cut out, I think.
Oh, was I gone?
That sentence you said cut out. The last sentence. Something did it. Did it something you said did in fact exist. But that
Amy Rose?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a bit funny then.
Yeah.
Did the universe just redact her?
I guess.
I tried to bring up the fact that Amy Rose existed.
Yes.
And my headset said no.
No, apparently.
Shut that crap down.
Go back and say that line again. Start that sentence over again. I'll edit it so it is not, like nothing happened.
You've been listening to the Bumblecast, a co-production of Bumble King Comics and the KNGI Network. Original theme music composed by Ken Coda Snyder. Remixed intro by T-Lopes. Find out more information, along with podcast feeder links, MP3 downloads, and more at bumbleking.com and kngi.org.
Sorry I sound funny.
Yeah, you're weird.
Yeah, well, thank you.